right, let's jump into Vivi.
You want a vivisection.
Okay, Jay, what's the movie we're reviewing for the vivisection today?
The movie that we're doing this week is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Cool.
Do you want me to just go into the full...
Yeah, why don't you give us a recap?
Yeah. So, Eternal Sunshine was released in 2004 by director Michel Gondry. It was written by Charlie Kaufman, and it has story credits for Charlie Kaufman, Michel Gondry, and Pierre Bismuth. It's starring Jim Carrey and Kate Winslet, and the budget is estimated about $20 million. So, Eternal Sunshine is about a young couple that goes through a really bad breakup, to say the least. And they individually decide to erase their memories of each other through like a new state-of-the-art procedure. Mm-hmm. And while this is happening, I think it's worth mentioning that Frodo is stealing Kate Winslet's underwear and being a total creep.
And by Frodo, you mean Elijah Wood.
Of course. Yeah, Elijah Wood. And while that's happening, there's also like another love triangle that's unfolding, which is a big part of the story as well. And we'll get into that. When Eternal Sunshine opened, its opening weekend, it made about $8 million, and all time it's sitting at $74 million. It's actually Charlie Kaufman's best performing film at the box office, even to today. And this is a movie that is really highly regarded. You could ask 100 film students what their favorite movie is, and I'm betting at least half of them will have this in their top five.
Is that true with you too?
No, not true with me. Actually, I don't hate this movie by any means, but it's definitely not one of my favorites. And I'm sure we'll get to talking and maybe I'll explain a little better why that is. But right now on IMDb, Eternal Sunshine holds 8.3, and on Rotten Tomatoes it's at 93%. When it was released, it was received very well. And Roger Ebert gave it a 3.5 stars and later revised it to 4 stars out of 4.
Wow.
And at the 2005 Oscars, it won for Best Writing, Original Screenplay from Charlie Kaufman, of course. Mm-hmm. And Kate Winslet was also nominated for Best Actress.
Nice. Now, with the Rotten Tomatoes, was that audience and critics or just critics?
That is the tomato meter, which I believe is just critics. Its audience score is at 94%. So maybe that's why I said 93. It's like the average.
Yeah. I always love seeing when the critics and the audience are really different. Cause I'm curious about that. Like Hail Caesar has a dramatically different, I think it was like something like 89% critics and like 43% audience.
Oh, wow.
Which is disappointing.
It's one of my favorite movies, but yeah, it's a really good movie.
Yeah, cool. Let's dive into the structure. Let's deconstruct this motherfucker.
Story structure.
So when we're deconstructing, we always go to the story kinetics template. Story template. It's the 4-act template, and basically we're referring to the template as a prototype, as a reference. I never say that a movie or a novel or a story needs to measure up to the template. It's pretty much just like a compass where you start to navigate and deconstruct the structure so you can see how the bones and the machinery under the hood are working. And of course, it's a 4-act structure, 8 sequences. One of these days we need to do a story bite where we talk about just sequence and the sequence approach. And how that relates to acts and how that relates to plot points. But generally speaking, we're looking at 24 plot points, 4 acts, 8 sequences, and it all works out to be about 3 plot points per sequence that culminate at certain landmarks. And these landmarks are what really defines the progress of the story. Landmarks are a combination of conflicts and emotional events. And we're gonna and it's where the scene or where the movie takes dramatic emotional turns. So we're going to take Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and measure it up to the template. I never say that a movie or a novel or a story needs to measure up to the template or line it up to the template and see what we can learn from it as we deconstruct it. Before we jump into that, I want to ask you a question. Mm-hmm. Is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind a romance?
I think so, yes.
Yeah. Why do you think? Well, define romance for me. What's a romantic movie?
A romantic movie, in my terms at least, is a movie about love or a relationship. And this movie definitely checks that box.
Okay, so like, for example, Antichrist.
I shouldn't have come here. Get out!
Nature is Satan's church.
Not exactly, no. No. I think that movie's a little bit different because its tone is so... I don't even know how to describe it. But... I mean, if someone really argued that it's a romance to me, I wouldn't necessarily have that much against it. Because, I mean, yeah, at the end of the day, it is about this couple trying to get through the loss of their child, right?
Yeah.
So it's a little romantic.
Where are you?
So any story about a relationship, any film about love is romantic.
Yes, on some level, at least.
On some level, okay.
I'm not saying it can't be something else as well. I'm not saying that it can't be something more than that. But yeah, I would argue that if it's about love or a relationship, that it would qualify as a romance.
I can't do this.
Okay, cool. Well, I want to, as we deconstruct it, I want that question to kind of linger in your brain for a little bit to kind of evaluate what Michelle Gondry and Charlie Kaufman are saying about the nature of love, specifically the kind of love that Joel and Clem have. Mm-hmm. So let's look at the structure. Now, of course, whenever we're looking at the structure, the first thing we want to look at is the dramatic question. Now, we've talked about dramatic question in every episode. It's one of the tent poles for identifying the landmarks in every movie. And the dramatic question is always phrased is, will the character, will the protagonist achieve X? Okay. So, and then that ties directly into the climax, which is the answer to the dramatic question. So in the case of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, what is the dramatic question, Jay?
The dramatic question is, will Joel get a second chance at love with his beloved Clementine?
Okay, so you got the will, which mm-hmm. is projecting forward. Joel is the protagonist. Get a second chance at love. I think that's a little bit of a broad way of articulating the question. Like, if you were to pitch the concept of this movie saying it's about a guy who gets a second chance at love, doesn't really tell us anything. It only tells us that it's, you know, about a guy who's in love with somebody or wants another chance at love. But this has a very specific high concept behind the movie.
Mm-hmm.
and let's talk about high concepts. So high concept, it's something that people talk about a lot when you're pitching, when you're developing something, is, you know, a lot of studios tend to lean more toward high concept. And the basis of a high concept movie or a high concept story is where the idea is central to the story. Okay, so Orson Scott Card released this book about character and viewpoint. And in it, he talks about this thing called a Mice Quotient. Actually, it might have been in his science fiction and fantasy books. He has two books that are fantastic books. Strongly recommend them. I love Ender's Game. A lot of other card stuff I'm not really a fan of, especially his legal documents. But he has two books that are really great that are about storytelling, that are about writing. And he talks about this thing called the Mice Quotient. And the Mice, it's an acronym, which basically is milieu, idea, character, or event. And he says each story is usually about one or two of those things. A milieu, which is the like the setting, the location where they're going. It's all about travel. The idea, usually like sci-fi, tends to be about, like, you know, what if you could erase someone's memory or erase someone out of your memory? You know, that's. And then character, which is where you, you know, kind of dive into just following the character, telling their life story, you know, like David Copperfield, that kind of stuff. And then event is about, you know, everybody's point of view or character's point of view of this huge cataclysmic or cultural or societal experience that everybody's sharing. And what tends to, what the studios tend to say that they're looking for is high concept, which is you prioritize the idea. For example, there was that movie about a guy who has a magical remote control, and he can fast forward or pause or rewind time and everything like that. That's the high concept idea. And what I love about Charlie Kaufman is he's really good at taking high concept ideas, but exploring them through character and really emphasizing and prioritizing complex layered characters through the high concept. And that's what I think a great writer does. We see lots of high concept stories that are like, that's a cool concept. And then, you know, they'll kind of throw in some gags, throw in some set pieces and call it a day. Put a nice logo, get a nice soundtrack on there, get some attractive looking people, and then you got a movie. But the great writers really take that high concept, kind of tap into the internal metaphors, what they mean to these characters, and explore a layered psychological phenomena beneath the hood of it. And that's what I think is true with The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, is he took this high concept of idea of what if you could erase someone from your memory, and use that as who are the kind of people that would choose to do this procedure, and what psychological machinations would drive them to take part in this, and how can we use this mechanism to dive into their unconscious. And that's what I love so much about it. So if you're pitching the high concept version of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, you're coming from kind of a character approach, which is, will he find love again? Mm-hmm. You know, that's what he wants. That's his character. But or will he have a second chance at love? But the concept, the idea that the whole story is wrapped around is largely about the procedure, the lacuna procedure.
Mm-hmm.
So if I were going to sit in the room and, or if I were in an elevator, well, don't ever pitch in the elevator. Just don't ever do it. But if you have like just a quick minute to get an impression, to get your idea across, your log line, with Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and especially with a dramatic question, you want to have that amnesia procedure as part of the story, as part of the pitch. So the procedure should be a part of the dramatic question. Will Joel... And then what does he want to achieve with the procedure?
I mean, initially he wants to rid his mind of Clementine, but as we later find out in the movie, he wants to actually hold on to a memory of her.
Good. Exactly. So we find out actually pretty quick, right around 30 minutes, that he doesn't want to erase Clementine. He thinks he does at first when he signs up for the procedure. Then immediately has buyer's remorse and is like, wait, I don't want to do this. So the dramatic question actually becomes, will Joel resist the procedure? Will he overcome the procedure? The procedure is erasing Clementine from his memory. And almost immediately he regrets it. So the rest of the story, all of Act 2, 3, and 4, are all about him, about Joel trying to escape the effects of the procedure and hold on to some memory of Clementine. So the dramatic question was probably best identified as, will Joel resist the amnesia procedure or the lacuna procedure? And then from there, the climax is the answer to the dramatic question. What is the climax?
The climax is they do decide to stay together or get back together.
Cool. They do make the decision. So in other words, he does overcome the procedure. Not in the way we expect, but in a way that is mostly satisfying. And we're going to talk about that in the plot holes, about what is a little bit unsatisfying about it. But in a very clever, interesting way. Okay. So once we go, once we've identified the dramatic question, the climax, which is, yes, he does end up staying with Clementine. We go to the impetus. Now, the impetus is a presentation of the problem. This is the problem that he's going to be addressing the entire time. So what is the impetus?
The impetus in Eternal Sunshine is when Joel discovers that Clementine had her memories erased.
Good. Exactly. Why is that the impetus?
That's what kickstarts the events of the rest of the movie and really ultimately gets Joel to also undergo the procedure.
Exactly. See, when I first was deconstructing this, my first impression was that the impetus was the moment where Patrick shows up and knocks on the window. Because you're like, okay, that's the moment where everything kind of turns left and everything seems weird. And they're like, okay, this isn't just two people falling in love. There's something else going on here. And Patrick is the introduction of that. But after reviewing it and looking at the real actual physical bones, we don't understand what the problem is. We're not beginning to learn what the stakes are until he learns that Clementine has erased him. And then he says, that's it. I want the procedure too. So you're absolutely right. The impetus comes in right around 20 minutes when he learns that he's been erased by Clementine. That Clementine has erased him from her memory. And then he decides he wants to go forward with it as well. So once we get the impetus, we now have the impetus, the dramatic question, that becomes the whole spine. Now we want to follow the emotional arcs. So we go to the midpoint and then to the low point, and those kind of become the connection, the connector points, or the junction between the dramatic question and the climax. So what would you say the midpoint is for Eternal Sunshine?
Yeah, so the midpoint is, I think they're in Joel's memory, but he is in the woods with Clementine, right?
Okay.
And they decide to go back and go further back into Joel's memories to try to hide there.
Good. So the moment where they try to hide Clementine in his memories, why is that the midpoint?
As you described before, it kind of marks like a transition in their strategy.
Okay, so good, exactly. It marks a transition in their strategy. So there's, you know, there are lots of scenes where they're kind of taking pretty dramatic emotional turns, but it's really when they change strategy that you mark a new act and you arrive at a certain culmination. So up to this point, Act 2 is where he is running with Clementine and he's just trying to hold on to the memories. So he's literally experiencing all the memories as the machine goes through the procedure, and he just tries to hold on to her. And then he tries to run from one memory of her to another memory of her, keep trying to hold on to her. And the procedure is locating it and destroying it. So at the midpoint is when, you know, they're saying, like, let's hide you where I don't belong. Let's hide you in your childhood memories. And he wraps her in a coded metaphor and buries her in memories of his childhood, even though he never knew her.
I do want to say one thing. When I was watching this movie the most recent time, something that kind of stood out to me, I think it was only a scene or two before this point in the movie. Joel finally has a positive memory of Clementine. I think they're like sitting on the couch or something like that, or maybe they're even laying in bed together. But it's really the first positive memory that Joel has of Clementine. Everything up to that point was, you know, the memory of her getting her memory erased and them just arguing, all their fights and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And this is the first time that Joel actually says, oh, I just want to hold on to this one memory. And for me at first, that was kind of the midpoint, but maybe that's the start of the midpoint. That's when he's fully realizing that he wants to hold on to her. And then the actual midpoint that we just discussed is when he finds a way to potentially hold on to that memory of her.
See that? Okay, that's a really good point. Let's talk about that a little bit. So we know that as soon as he's in that, it looks like a dentist's office, but it's the Lacuna office, and he's standing over the shoulder looking at himself, and he's like, what's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, everything's distorted a little bit. And then he overhears Patrick in the background, and he's saying, he's like, he's stealing Clementine. Like, right off the bat, he starts saying, like, wait, I don't want to do this. Hold on. Wait, wake me up. I don't want to do this. So as soon as he resists the procedure, we've already crossed the threshold into the second act. We've already posed the dramatic question, will he resist the procedure?
Mm-hmm.
The fact that he jumps through every single scene and all of his memories of her are the breakup, or what led up to the breakup. Plot, just looking at the plot, it's still the same strategy, but you're raising the stakes. Like him saying, wait a minute, I actually really want this memory. This is a good memory. I don't want to let go of this. The reason why that's not the midpoint is because he's still resisting the procedure the same way.
Mm-hmm.
He's still just following all the memories of her, And because of that, you're pretty much following, like, this is how Joel would hold on to or would solve this problem. Just try and hold on to something. It's all like it's him trying to solve the problem in the way that the only way he can think of. So at the midpoint, that's when it starts to transition. And that's why it's significant that Clem is the one who suggests that they hide her in a place she doesn't belong.
I think another really good marker for this midpoint is I think this is also when Joel opens his eyes in the real world, right?
Yeah.
He almost is successful at waking himself up, but then they put him under again.
Yeah, that's a really great point. I didn't think about that.
It's kind of like intercut almost with that scene in his memories.
Yeah.
If I remember
correctly. Exactly. The midpoint is all about disillusionment. It's where you think you're going to get what you want. You think you're going to solve the problem. And then the floor drops out beneath you and you realize you're further away from your goal than you were before. Mm-hmm. And that's why, like, him opening his eyes is a perfect example of that disillusionment. It's a great visual metaphor of it. Cool. So the midpoint, definitely when they decide to change their strategy and try and hide her in the subconscious of other memories that they can't track her. Okay. So from the midpoint, we want to go to the low point. What would you say the low point is?
The low point would definitely have to be when Joel's memories are officially erased at the end of the procedure. And then
So the procedure is completely done.
Mm-hmm.
So the procedure is successful. Is the procedure successful?
Mostly. It seems like Joel has held on to just the tiniest bit of a memory or something.
Good. So, yes, I totally agree with you. The low point is when the procedure is complete and they believe they've completely erased Clementine from his memory. And for all intents and purposes, they have, except one little whisper from his subconscious that says, "Meet me in Montauk."
Mm-hmm.
That's that kind of lingering, like, it's the one thing that they didn't erase because they didn't connect the two, which was, of course, the place that they originally met in the real life. Good. So this kind of gives us an overall map. We can see that, you know, if we just look at the diagram, you know, we start off from the point where he finds out about the procedure, and it's just a slide downward. This is a very melancholical tone. It's largely just about reminiscing about losing someone you deeply love. It's really, you want to have a few drinks while you're watching this. So from there, we want to identify the hook, and the hook is the last major landmark. Not the last major. We'll talk about the secondary landmarks, but the primary landmarks, the last one is the hook. And what's the hook in this movie?
It's starting media res. It's Clementine and Joel. Their meet cute scene and just their, like, the start of their newfound relationship, or what seems to be their newfound relationship.
Yeah. So use the term in media res. Explain to us what that is.
Yeah, so that's when...
I totally know what that means, by the way. Why don't you explain that to us?
I don't know exactly, like, what it means specifically, so maybe you could help out with that. But in movies, it's when a movie starts at a later point but brings that to the beginning of the movie.
Good, yeah. You're exactly right. So the movie starts out later in the story, and it presents it.
Right.
Now, in media res, it's Latin for it means in the middle of things or in the midst of things. And
I knew you would know the Latin.
So usually it kind of became this trend after Pulp Fiction. A lot of people started using in media res, and they almost started abusing it to the point where, like, a lot of critics were saying, like, you know, starting off, we're done with in media res. Stop starting your movie or your story or your novel, you know, 75% of the way through or at the low point or the moment of, like, high crisis. Because what often happened was they didn't have a strong first act. So they would resort to in media res to try and say, like, you know, well, this, you know, we're going to get back to this. The opening scene isn't very interesting. So we're going to get back to, this is where it's going to go. So it becomes like a promise that the movie does take on some sort of interesting tension. But then they go back to the first act and they don't have really interesting character development, or they haven't found an interesting way to develop the characters. A really good example of in media res, I think, is like Get Out. We've got that great scene where the guy's walking down the neighborhood and he's being stalked by this car that turns around. So you're not introducing the main character. You know what? I take that back. That's
I don't think that's media res. No.
I'm completely wrong. That's not a media res at all.
All good. We'll cut this out.
Yeah. Because I never want to be wrong on the podcast. I'm always
right. Yeah, for sure.
I'm wrong all the time. what's a good example of in media res? Oh.
City of God.
What was that Philip Seymour Hoffman Mission Impossible?
Oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about. It's been a while. I don't know which one that was.
Yeah. So that one was, I believe that was a J.J. Abrams one. It starts off at this moment of high crisis. It's a set piece. And then the movie starts off like, you know, 2 months before or 3 weeks before. And you're just like, and then the tension always drops right after the in media res. So anyways, the point of in media res is use it if you want to. Use it if you can, if it serves the story, if it kind of becomes like a frame story. Mission, the profit margin starts with in media res. And the whole story is this interrogation scene. We keep going back to this interrogation scene where we're learning a little bit more about Tommy Knox. The profit margin is my first novel. And it has this kind of frame story. So we're starting right at the low point and we're building up to the moment where he gets arrested by the Secret Service. And we're wondering why he got arrested by the Secret Service. So it's one of those things where you want to use it in a smart way. So with Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, it starts in media res, a scene that actually takes place later in the movie. It's the only time we're actually cheating the time. So the first time I watched Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, I thought it was a movie going backward in time. When the truth is it's actually a movie going progressively forward in time. It's just we're following the procedure, which is reverse engineering all of its memories or tracking backwards through all of his memories, which gives it that kind of reconstruction. And of course, you got to reference Memento if you're citing that kind of story structure. Now, Memento came out before this movie, right?
It did. Yeah. Interesting story with that. Charlie Kaufman, after Memento was released, was very discouraged to keep writing Eternal Sunshine and was eventually convinced to come back on board.
Really?
But, yeah. So I think he just saw Memento and the fact that it had such a similar structure to Eternal Sunshine did something to discourage him.
See, that's interesting because it's a completely different movie.
Yeah, very different movies.
It's not even the same structure. It's not even the same concession. I mean, it reverse engineers his memories, but
right. There's similarities to the structure, but it's not exactly the same. And maybe that's why eventually he was able to be convinced to come back on board. I think he was already having some troubles with writing it. He struggled with some of those devices that we were just talking about where the memories were going back in time. He struggled to kind of figure out a good way to balance all of that. And so maybe that played a part of it. I don't know.
That's really interesting. I mean, I think he did it successfully. I would never.
I agree.
They're completely different movies. And I would argue that Eternal Sunshine and Spotless Mind is actually more effective at diving into the psychology of the characters than Memento. Memento is great for high stakes and tension. But
yeah, I totally agree with all of that.
Are you getting a lot of scouts snoring? Okay, so the hook, definitely. Joel and Clem meet for the first time again in media res. This is post-procedure. Why do you think they started off that way?
I think it's a good way to introduce these characters' relationship and to kind of get acquainted with them before we really get into the details of what happened and the high concept reality of what's going on.
Okay. That's a good point. Do you feel like it served the story well?
I do. Yeah. I actually think it's a good choice for this movie. Ultimately, really? I do have some issues with it, which I think we'll discuss pretty soon, but ultimately I think it was the right decision and something that helped the movie.
Okay, cool. Yeah. It's a really unconventional opening. It's 17 minutes. And the credits for the movie don't start until 17 minutes into it, which is really unusual. Like for most movies, they're off and running, and like by 17 minutes, they're almost at the dramatic question. They're almost into Act Two or close to it. Cool. So we've staked out the major landmarks of the story. We look at the bones, and this is largely kind of the overall structure of the story. And then from there, we can start kind of fill in these other scenes that kind of show the emotional map of the story and this kind of slow, gradual downhill movement the story goes into. Now, one thing that we usually want to identify as one of the landmarks is a subplot. Subplots tend to be a plot that's independent of the dramatic question of the primary plot and becomes kind of like a mini problem or conflict they need to resolve that doesn't affect whether they get closer or not to the climax or resolving the primary dramatic question. Now, rather than a subplot, they have a kind of parallel story. Tell me about that parallel story.
Yeah, so it's an affair happening between Mary, played by Kirsten Dunst, Dr. Mirzwiak, played by Tom Wilkinson.
Yeah, good. And what does that subplot reveal about the story?
About
the characters? Why there?
Because it's kind of the second impetus, if you will, of events that lead to the end of the movie, and that's the fact that Kirsten Dunst's character, Mary, has actually undergone this procedure before because she was having a previous affair with the doctor. And she realizes that she's had her memories erased and finally decides to end the cycle. And that leads us to the climax of the movie.
Cool. Very good. So in a way, even though this is a parallel story, it leads directly into the climax. So technically, you could argue that it's not a subplot, that it's a secondary thread that feeds into the climax.
Yeah, I would say it's too integral to the plot to be a subplot, but it's close. It's as close as you can get to a subplot without it actually being one.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I agree with that assessment. Cool. So we've got this overall structure, and this is strictly plot point. So this is strictly character wants this, and this is the obstacle they face, and this is how they resolve it. And scene by scene, we're plotting things out. A lot of people separate plot from character, and I don't think that's possible. Plot is always the expression of a character's internal drives, which leads us to character and theme. Let's dive a little bit into the psychology of the characters. Now, we always look at the protagonist's psychology. At first, let's identify the protagonist. Who is the main character in this movie?
Be Joel Barish.
Joel Barish. Very good. Played by
Jimothy Carey.
Yes. So Jim Carrey, a very talented young actor. look forward to more from him. So Joel Barish, he's kind of a shy, introverted, insecure man, baby. And so what we do is we start with the external and work our way inward. And the first thing we look at is the conscious desire. And we move from the conscious desire to the unconscious drive, the Achilles heel, the moral imperative, and we use all this to identify the central theme. And with the really successful stories, we see the theme just seeping through every pore of the movie. Every single scene is an illustration or an elaboration on the theme. The first thing we look at is the conscious desire, Joel's conscious desire. And the conscious desire is what the character knows they want from scene to scene. And the conscious desire, we average that into the overall story. So from the dramatic question to the climax. So what is Joel's conscious desire?
Yeah, so Joel's conscious desire lines up pretty well with the dramatic question, I would think, right? Is that usually the case?
Yeah, exactly.
And in this case, it's Joel wanting to hold on to that memory of Clementine.
Good, exactly. So he wants to hold on to Clem's memory. That is, he knows that he wants to do that. And then every single tactic he uses is an attempt to hold on to those memories. Every single scene is about addressing that conflict. So from the conscious desire, that illuminates or gives us an idea of what the unconscious drive is. Now, the unconscious drive is, this is where we do the kind of the, you know, armchair psychology work. When we're watching movies, we're all psychologists. We're all sitting there in the theaters, identifying with them, trying in some way to identify what it is, what is the machine, what is the weaknesses, what is the ambitions that are driving these characters to make their decisions. And especially in the best stories, it's not an easy answer. In fact, generally speaking, you want to try and structure your stories in a way that the plot is actually fairly simple, but the characters are complex. And this is a great example of that. You have basically a guy who wants to hold on to his girlfriend's memories. That's a straightforward plot. But the thing that motivates him and the choices he's making are very complex. And that's what makes this such a great balance of character. Often when you have really complex plots, it becomes very difficult for us to dive into the depth of character. Like if you look at Inception, for example, as much as I love Inception, that's part of my criticism. It's a complex plot. Nolan tends to do this. The Nolan brothers tend to write very complex structures, complex plot, and complex obstacles, trying to dive into the character, but not really allowing those obstacles to reveal more about the layers beneath or the unconscious drives. So in the case of Joel, we know that he has certain motives. We know that he has certain kind of sacred values. And that's what the unconscious drive is. It's the values that inform our decisions. What would you say is the unconscious drive that's revealed, or how would you articulate that?
I think the unconscious desire is Joel's dependency on Clementine.
Oh, okay.
But that's
interesting.
But I'm thinking you have a different answer.
No, actually, I think that's another way of explaining it. Like, the story is all about a guy who's going through a breakup and he's really hurting from it. He is not dealing well with this, which, you know, it's normal. Most of us, if we deeply care about somebody and then we lose them, you go through a mourning process. Mm-hmm. And that mourning process is healthy. But he doesn't deal with it in a healthy way. His first response is, you know, well, fuck her. I'm going to get back at her. I'm going to do exactly to her what she did to me. Which, right. You know, kind of indicates his maturity level. but then the question becomes, like, so what is motivating him to want to behave that way? He took this very personally. And I think at the core of this is his kind of unresolved issues of abandonment with his mother specifically.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason why I say it's abandonment from his mother is because that's where we get the scenes. Now, there could be some issue of abandonment with his father, but we don't have any scenes. Those are the scenes that we get to work with. So those are the small little pieces of metaphor that we start to use to inform his unconscious drive. So at the core of this kind of like, you can see how his unresolved feelings for his mother, his anxiety about feeling abandoned, is what drives him to make this like ridiculous mistake, okay? Or what drives him to do this like ridiculous procedure. He's paying someone to do brain damage to cause him to forget a whole life experience, like 2 years of his life, I think. So when you look at it that way, it's like the unconscious drive has within it embedded a kind of Achilles heel, which is a weakness.
Okay,
what would you say is his weakness?
His weakness is, I don't know, like his almost childish behavior.
Yeah, exactly. I wrote it down as he wants to get back at Clem for erasing him. Like, he's not doing the procedure because he wants to be healthy and this is a good step forward for him to emotionally deal with these problems. This was him trying to say, you're going to erase me, I'm going to erase you, see how you like it. Which is, you know, it shows that that's kind of the growth that he has to go through, which means, and that lesson that he's facing is going to force him to address this thing called the moral imperative. The moral imperative is simply just that moral rule that you're going to come up against. That's the source of all the conflict. Like, if you want to survive in the mafioso world, you have to learn to never narc on the people you're with. You never go to the feds and never, you know. So that's the moral imperative of that world. Now in this, the moral imperative is directly informed by the fact that he wanted to erase her. He basically had this huge emotional underdevelopment, this kind of emotional pocket that he needs to address. So the moral imperative, I would say, is erasing memories empties us of meaning. And every single scene is all about how Joel is resolving that Achilles heel, his childish behavior, by learning this lesson, which is erasing memories empties us of meaning. So once we've identified all this, now the moral imperative is the source of the conflict. It's the moral rule that you come up against. But the theme is the takeaway from that moral imperative. Whether you actually successfully achieve it, whether you actually do arc or grow or develop, or whether it forces you into a kind of bitterness or embracing your Achilles heel. So in the case of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, what is the theme? What is the takeaway from this story? What do you think Joel learns through this whole experience?
Nothing, because his memories were erased.
See, okay, good. That actually speaks directly to the theme. He completely resets the last 2 years of his life because all of that learning, all of that growth that he experienced by being with Clementine is completely taken away, which to me does emphasize the value of love. I think on the surface, the central theme of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is that through love, we learn to become the people we want to be. Like if we look at it, Clementine is everything Joel wishes he could be, but doesn't have the guts to do it. It doesn't have the security or the ambition that she does. And by seeing her, he's like, this is amazing. I want to try and engage this. I want to be more like her. And so when he's with her, he's more brave, he's more silly, he's more everything that he wants to be. And then by wiping her out, he loses all of that. Mm-hmm. So I would say the takeaway is kind of on the surface level, the theme is, you know, through love, we become the people we want to be, that we're capable of becoming. But I think it actually goes a little bit deeper than that, right? Because this is Charlie Kaufman, who I think is an absolute genius, he writes on a much more sophisticated level. I think he is using this kind of romantic meta story, or this romantic narrative, to build an argument about the nature of love itself from a very kind of critical point of view. And I think to understand that, we need to look at Mary Svevo. So on the surface, we have this character arc, this kind of, actually, it's almost like the opposite of a character arc. We learn that Joel learned a lot from Clementine in their first relationship, and now he's just has to reset. But what he did learn is that he's going to want to hold on to these memories, that there's something inside him that's saying, this experience with Clementine is something you need to go through. Maybe it means that they're going to be together forever, or maybe it means that she is the lesson I need to learn in life. And by erasing that lesson, even though it hurts, it's something that he still feels like. There's something inside him is telling him he still needs to go through that. So from the theme, we start to get to the question of what is this movie really about? What is Charlie Kaufman and Michel Gondry saying about the nature of love? And I think the key to that is this character, Mary Svevo, played by Kirsten Dunst. There's this moment where Mark Ruffalo specifically says, I really like you, Mary Svevo. And it was that moment watching it, like, you know, for the fourth or fifth time, that I was like, Svevo, that's such a unique, specific name. So, you know, that's one of those little clues, that those little strands that you pick on, you start picking at it and you're like, wait, there's actually something here. There's something really fascinating. But before we go into Svevo, do you know what the word lacuna actually means?
I do not, no.
Yeah, I didn't either. I thought it was just a clever, interesting, poetic name. It actually is Latin, once again, and it means gap. Specifically referred to like lakes or ponds. Like lagoon a kind of small lake is English derivation of lacuna. So it means like a small gap, but lacuna now is specifically means a missing portion in a book or a manuscript. So this, the, you know, the company is named after, you know, what it does, which is it eliminates whole chapters from your book of life, which I thought, you know, it's Charlie Kaufman. It's brilliant. But what I think the story Eternal Sunshine is really talking about is using addiction to cope with those emotional gaps, is that we all have gaps, and we're trying to keep those gaps in place in order to deal with them. Or it's specifically talking about addiction and how addiction, we use addiction to cope with the gaps in our personal lives. But more specifically, alcoholism. It's all about, like, I believe the metaphor for the procedure is a metaphor for alcoholism itself. The way we use, or the way we can abuse and use alcohol to dull the senses, soften the feeling, but also create a kind of amnesia for ourselves. Now, there's several subtle ways that Kaufman wove this into the story. At the very beginning, we have that scene where Joel says, you know, does this cause any brain damage? And he says, it technically is brain damage, you know, on par with a heavy night of drinking or a night of heavy drinking. And I think that's the first kind of strand connecting the two. And then later, when Mark Ruffalo's character is saying, like, you know, we got to get this procedure started, he makes this symbol, like he holds like he's going to take a drink. And then Elijah Wood reaches down into the boxes that has all the gear and the equipment, and he pulls out a beer, a Falling Rock beer. And then later, you know, Elijah Wood is talking to him, and he's like, hey, you know, he's just trying to talk about his new girlfriend. And Mark Ruffalo says, we got to focus here. And we see the specific image. It's framed in such a way, it says, we have to focus, we got to get the procedure started. And he points at the beer, at the alcohol. And then on top of that, when the procedure is completely done, they take the helmet off, and literally out from underneath the helmet, as if it was part of the procedure, Mark Ruffalo pulls up a beer. Now, I think it works as a gag, but it also works on that extra layer that says that this procedure is really about alcoholism. And what confirmed that for me is looking into this Mary Svevo, or the surname for Svevo. So I found this one writer called Italo Svevo, who's an Italian writer. He was considered a pioneer of the psychological novel in Italy and is best known for his classic modernist novel, La Conciencia. Let me see if I can say this right. La Conciencia di Geno. Oh, fuck it. La Conciencia di Geno, 1923, a work that had a profound effect in the movement. So it's he was the pioneer of the psychological novel. And it says the work showed the author's interest in theories of Sigmund Freud is written in the form of memories of Geno's Cosini, who writes them at the insistence of his psychoanalyst. So the whole story is novel is a kind of backtracking of his memories, but a specific system of memories. He sought psychoanalysis in order to discover why he was addicted to nicotine. And that's at the core. That was his objective. As he reveals in his memories, each time he had given up smoking with the iron resolve that this would be the ultima cigaretta, the last cigarette, he experienced the exhilarating feeling that he was now beginning life over without the burden of his old habits and mistakes. Oh, that feeling was so strong that he found smoking irresistible, if only so that he could stop smoking again in order to experience the thrill once more. So at the core of this, Italo Svevo's novel is all about the immense elation of creating a kind of amnesia, forgetting what it was like to smoke cigarettes for the first time so he could experience it for the first time. And that's ultimately what Joel and Clementine are doing. They're erasing each other from their memory so that they can fall in love for the first time again, because the falling in love part was their favorite part. There's this one poet that I loved. I saw a lecture at CalArts. I can't remember the name of the poet, but he said that basically, like, this is, if you look at love as a timeline, as like your body is a timeline of love, Like, you know, if you kind of stretch your arms out, and on your right hand this is where you see each other for the first time. It kind of grabs you. And then here's like the first kiss or the first time you sleep together. This is the first time you tell each other you love each other. This is the first time you say, you know what, let's be together. Let's make this work. Then you go into the body of the relationship. And then from there, this is when you realize it's not going to work out. This bicep is the last kind of passionate realization of things aren't work, that you have to let go soon. This is kind of the first major like insight that it's going to end. And this is the bitter, ugly let go. You know, this is the breakup. And he said, most poetry happens from here to here. And like all the really great, meaty, emotional stories are all about the arms, the body of the story. There's not a lot of poetry or stories about what's going on in the body of the relationship. And that's what's so great about this is these are story. This is a story, I think, ultimately about people who love this part of the relationship, the kind of grabbing, the beginning of the relationship. And this just became this ugly, bitter thing. So they want to just start over and experience this first initial growth. And at the core of that, that reveals this really great, fascinating, you know, we go back to Sigmund Freud specifically, and I think Charlie Kaufman was citing Svevo for this. You can see that the core of this is largely feelings of issues of abandonment with his mother. He feels like, you know, the few times we see his mother, she's using alcohol as a way of kind of, you know, entertaining herself, making light of it, but it also is associated with how he copes with gaps. He wanted his mother's attention. He feels this yearning for it, which we all experience. That doesn't mean that his mother was a bad mother. It only means that Joel was experiencing it as if it was some form of abandonment. And so, you know, and then we learned that alcoholism was part of the reason why there was that distance between them. You know, we see that scene, like, how about a cocktail? I know it's not five, but blah, blah, blah. So, at the core of that, this unconscious drive, we see, that Joel and Clem are really, this isn't a story about, romanticism so much, and even about healthy love. It's largely about two people who are using love as a kind of addiction. And that might be what really drove their desire to have this procedure. It wasn't so much that they just want to forget about everything. It was actually kind of this kind of fucked up way for them to romantically restart their addiction and say, I want to experience Clementine for the first time. I want to experience Joel for the first time, because that was the best part of our relationship, which suggests both of them have the huge pockets of development that they experienced in their relationship. Because real relationships are, it's great falling in love, but the really great, meaty, beautiful stuff is what comes when you have this kind of really in-depth connection with somebody. So I don't think that this is Charlie Kaufman talking about love. I don't think it's a romantic story. I think it's a story about Joel and Clementine using their love like alcohol to fill their emotional gaps, rather than having an actual sophisticated, mature love, a meaningful love that could last. So looking at that, you know, you've got the character arc, which is kind of like what the character is learning, but what is the question that we can learn from that character? And I would say that love is actually, I would say that the theme, the takeaway from this story is actually that love is a vice we use to escape our misery. And when you use love in that way, you're ultimately going to be cheating yourself of the really meaningful experiences. Or am I wrong? Did I go down the rabbit hole? What are your thoughts on this?
No. I definitely see all the evidence and can agree with what you're presenting here. And I've always kind of thought that this movie is very much about your last little central theme line that you put down, that love is a vice we use to escape our misery. Because I think that ultimately their relationship between Joel and Clementine is not a healthy relationship and not something that is sustainable.
Yeah. I agree with you. Okay. So that kind of wraps up like our attempt at kind of trying to analyze Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Now let's shift from analysis to criticism with. So I had a couple plot holes or a couple of thoughts that I wanted to kind of work through them with you and see if you felt like they were a plot hole or if they were weak stories or just me being nitpicky. Okay. So the first one I think was really interesting is Clem a manic pixie dream girl? Now, what I mean by that is there's this trope that's used in a lot of, it seemed like it kind of cropped up in the 90s and we used a lot in the early 2000s, where the manic pixie dream girl is basically this girl who's super cute, super attractive. She's instantly, like, she's extroverted. She's fun. She's playful. She's everything usually the heterosexual male character is. And he's usually kind of an insecure, quiet introvert who finds, like, she fulfills all of his insecurities. She resolves all these. She takes the initiative. He doesn't have to risk anything. She takes all the risk. And ultimately, she, you know, it's kind of a fantasy of, like, an insecure man who doesn't want to take the initiative, which we see that with Joel quite a bit. One of the best versions I saw of this was Garden State. And by best, I mean, like, Natalie Portman, I think, was playing that manic pixie dream girl where she's just like, isn't my backpack great? And isn't this just, I'm just so crazy and fun and charismatic, when it's really just this fantasy that this adorable girl will just throw herself at this really insecure, introverted guy. But do you think that's true with Clementine and Joel?
I think it's mostly true, but like I literally just said, I feel like this movie is almost a cautionary tale about how a relationship like that doesn't really work. And so it's not quite fulfilling that trope 100%, but I do think that she's close to that.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I would argue that this is Kaufman commenting on that trope.
That makes sense, yeah.
And the main reason why is, first of all, he's pointing out, like most, for example, Garden State and everything, they're and Manic Pixie Dream Girls, they're always just talking about how awesome they are and how wonderful they are. They're kind of, it's this mat, like, adulation. The truth of it is not only is Clementine, yes, she's manic, she's all over the place, she's impulsive, she's extroverted, she likes a lot of attention, she walks into a room and just wants everybody to be looking at her and talking to her and be the subject of everybody, and that's how she finds important. So immediately there's kind of this dimension where you're seeing kind of the ugly side of it. But on top of that, the real key to that, that to see that this isn't just, you know, taking the manic pixie dream girl and romanticizing it, is I think Kaufman is commenting on it because of Patrick. Like, the way Elijah Wood plays Patrick, I think he is a caricature of the Joel character. He is the caricature of the counterpoint to the manic pixie dream girl, where, you know, he's a creep, he's obsessive, he's stealing her underwear, he uses this really nefarious means to stalk her and to learn all this private information, and then to tap into her psychological mechanisms that he learned by using these procedures, and then exploited that in such a way that she was, you know, he knew how to push all of her buttons, but not in any natural way. And so I think that's Kaufman kind of saying, like, he's the counterpoint to the manic pixie dream girl, basically this deeply insecure, underdeveloped baby boy who doesn't have any kind of actual emotional development. That's the kind of character that seeks out the manic pixie dream girl, mm-hmm. because then it seems like she's the answer to all of his problems. So yeah, I would agree with you. I think Clementine is a commentary on the manic pixie dream girl, but I don't think it's an illustration of the trope. I think it's a deconstruction of the trope, and then it elevates it to the next level. Same with the fact that Joel is an elaboration on that same criticism. Okay, so the next one. How does Clem have a new phone number if they erased her memory?
It was just part of the procedure that they got it all sorted out for.
So, do you know your phone number?
Yeah.
Do you have it memorized?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have anyone else's phone number memorized?
A few, yeah.
Okay, cool. So you had to go through a process of memorizing those numbers. Part of that is usually repetition, and you prioritized it. So if she's changed her number, that means she's had to memorize a new number. Mm-hmm. She knows that she has a new number, which means that number, that previous number, was associated with Joel. So my argument, my question is that they don't address is he says he tries to call her. Her number's been changed. So he goes to her work and she's there and she doesn't even recognize him. How is it possible that they have any kind of, how can she remember a new number if they've erased her memory?
Maybe they implanted the memory.
I mean, that's a whole different procedure. Or is it just, we don't want to see that scene because it's not that important?
I think it's almost definitely that.
Okay. So it's not a plot hole. It's just a, there's an invention because they did this, blah, blah, blah.
I mean, it's sort of a plot hole.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Okay, so you would say it's a little bit of a plot hole, but not like a major issue.
Right, yeah, it's a plot hole.
You don't want to have a scene where it's like, movie. And this is how you get a new number. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Because there's probably a few details that you could really nitpick like that if you analyze what a person would really have to go through in order for their memories to be erased and to continue living a normal life. Like, yeah. That didn't happen.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Why didn't Joel get a card from Lacuna informing him of the erasure?
Yeah, this is something I thought about too when I was watching the movie this time. And I have no idea. I can't figure it out except for the fact that it makes for a really dramatic scene.
Yeah. Yeah, that's actually a really good point. So it's almost like conflict for the sake of conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're going to be sending out cards saying, please do not mention Joel Barish to Clementine.
He's the number one that should be getting that card.
Absolutely. Like, and then the fact that, like, you know, there's a scene where he says, I'm sorry, you shouldn't have seen this. I apologize. It's like, he's the one that should see it. Otherwise, yeah. He's going to keep showing up. And then it's going to be traumatizing for her because she's completely, you know, this is a completely foreseeable conflict. It's a foreseeable problem. So would you say that's a plot hole?
Not a plot hole, but a plot warp, kind of.
A plot warp. Okay, I like that. A plot warp. It's a plot gap. It's a lacuna.
It's movie magic.
It's movie magic. Yeah, they solved it with movie magic. They fixed it in post. Let's see. I'm going to skip the Insidious, the emphatic. It's not that interesting. Okay, here's a big one. And I'm genuinely conflicted about this.
Mm-hmm.
How did Mary get the files delivered in one day?
I do have an answer for that.
Okay, real quick, I just want to be specific for the audience. So Joel wakes up from procedure. That day, he goes to Montauk. He meets Clementine. They sleep together. And then, what is it? The next day, they go to the lake, and then they wake up the next morning, or he drives her home the next morning, and it's waiting for them. Like, the file is waiting for him at home, and it's waiting for her, for Clementine, at her place. So they hear the cassettes of their memory, which means that Mary Svevo stole all the files and then delivered them to all the patients, and they arrived in one day. How is that possible in 2004?
Okay. So, Spider-Man 2 with Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst was also released in 2004. Maybe in that memory erasure, she didn't realize at the time that she was dating Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man. And then through the process of her realizing that her memory was erased, she figured it all out and got Peter Parker to do it for her.
Oh my God, you're blowing my mind. So, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is an expanded universe of the Spider-Man verse, of the Spider-Verse.
Yes.
Holy shit. So, Lacuna, that means Dr. Mearswack is actually a Spider-Man villain.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I want to see him in the next Spider-Man. Let's see if he's in, what are they calling it? I don't know. Far From Home? No, that was the last one.
That was the last one. Interesting. Okay, I gotta think about that one. That's interesting. No, I don't buy that for a second. I don't think that was a Marvel Universe thing at all.
Well, then let's just give it up for the United States Postal Service.
Actually, just before we started this podcast, I was rewatching the movie real quick, and I saw this one shot that I absolutely love now in the context of this question. There's a scene where Joel is at the very beginning. He's walking to Lacuna, and he's going to drop off every single artifact that he has of Clementine. And as he's crossing the street, a delivery van, a UPS van, almost hits him. He slams on the brakes, and he says, "Wake up, buddy." And then Joel continues across. He's like, sorry. And he continues across the street, which is great foreshadowing, because what that's saying is, literally, Mary Svevo's letter is going to be the thing that's the wake-up call.
Yeah.
It's kind of a nice little, like, poetic, like, that's Kaufman winking at the audience saying, hey, guess what? There's a lot more layers. That's what I mean by, like, great writing, is, like, even the little throwaway lines have lots of loaded meaning. And that's a really good example one. I think that's so fucking cool.
Ultimately, though, I do think it's just, a convenience plot point. They don't want to have the characters wait a couple of days to figure that out. It just makes sense for it to go smoothly.
Yeah, it makes sense. And you could argue, like, that was the relationship. I was going to say, you could argue that was the relationship that... hold on. I just got a text that showed up on there. You could argue that was the relationship that, you know, she was in Joel's apartment when all the shit hit the fan. So maybe she wanted to specifically fast track it to Joel and then to Clementine, because she saw all the fucked up shit that's happening. You could make that argument. Ultimately, it doesn't matter, because the plot needed to happen when it needed to happen. And, you know, it's something I didn't notice until watching it for like the, you know, 10th time.
Yeah.
And then so for further criticism, this isn't so much plot holes. My biggest criticism, if it is a criticism, I love this movie. I'm one of the, I was in art school. I was in film school when I saw this movie. So I loved it so much. It totally spoke to me. I love the aesthetic. I love Michel Gondry's cinematic style. I love Charlie Kaufman's writing. I love the performances. The whole cast I thought was fantastic. But my criticism is largely, so we have that scene in the, Borders bookstore where she works, or Barnes & Noble, one of the two. It's a bookstore where she works, and we see all the spines disappearing, and she says, "I'm not a concept," which again speaks to that manic pixie dream girl thing. She says, "I'm not a concept," you know, and then there's that, like, she just disappears, and he says goodbye to one of his last memories of her. And then the next scene is him going to Montauk, where they first met for the first time, his first memory of her, and how they run into the house, and he left her because he was all shy and embarrassed. And she says, "What if you stay?" And we see the same beat over and over and over again, which is, "Man, I'm really bummed out I'm losing you. I'm really bummed out I'm losing you." And both of those beats basically have the same kind of emotional value to them. They have the same kind of emotional impact, which is, it's really sad when she disappears.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of wish they found a way to take that. Like, I love the speech. "I'm not a concept." It's great. I wish they found a way to, like, it was a great opportunity to actually dive further into Joel's childhood. Cause they only, you know, went to him under his mother's table in the kitchen, and then him killing the bird with his friends, and then him and Clementine running around as, you know, the cowgirl. But we didn't get a lot more than that. Or we didn't get much more than that.
I would have liked to see more from that time period in his life, too. Especially because they brought so much importance to going deeper into his memories. And then it doesn't really feel like we get a lot of time there.
Yeah, just kind of skim the surface, and then they jump right back to memories of Clementine. So that would have been... Basically, it was just a small missed opportunity. And maybe in early drafts it had that. But it was a missed opportunity to really learn more about the psychological development. Like, why does Joel feel this abandonment? Was there some events that we missed out on? But in the end, you know, it's a minor criticism because it's such a fantastic story. It's so well put together.
Something that will also kind of go back into the plot holes, it's not exactly a criticism, but something that may not have worked well for me. We talked about this film starting in media res, and for me that kind of took a lot of the stakes out. Because the whole time we're going through this journey with Joel, through his memories, trying to hold on to a memory of Clementine, trying to have a way to keep a connection with her. But we already know that they've met up again the whole time. So even though I still feel like it takes us on an emotional journey and does a really good job from scene to scene, something about starting in media res does take out some of those stakes and answer some of those questions that we should be asking during the whole movie playing out.
That's a really good point. See, I'm trying to remember what I felt like the first time I watched it. Because I feel like the first time you watch the movie, it's so disorienting that you're not really sure that's in media res until the end of the movie. And then at the end of the movie, they reveal, oh, by the way, this wasn't the first time they actually met. The first time they met was years ago. And so that scene you saw at the beginning, it was actually the present.
Yeah, I do agree that it is a little bit disorienting, but there are definitely key details that tell you not too much further after we go back into present time that was media res. Like, we get this little scene with Elijah Wood. Get them talking about certain events like they would have happened when they first met or earlier in the relationship. That doesn't quite make sense with the first scene in media res. So I do think that there is enough information there that, you know, maybe if you're watching this at first, you might not pick it up immediately, but it's there. And I think it is visible.
Yeah, that's a fair point. That's a really good point. I didn't think about that. It's like, have you ever read Life of Pi or seen the movie?
I have not, no.
Okay, so the whole premise is a journalist goes to interview this guy about his life adventure, and he tells the story of how he survived a shipwreck with him and a tiger stuck on a raft. And it's the whole adventure of him going across the sea and everything. And the problem is that, you know, it's an adventure story, and the key to an adventure story, the question is always, are they going to survive? And because the journalist is interviewing him, you know, 40 years later, you're like, well, he definitely survives. So all of the stakes were completely undercut. You never wonder if he's actually going to survive, if the tiger's going to maul him or kill him, or, you know, they're going to drown or die at sea or eat each other. So that story would have benefited by just getting rid of the journalist story and just tell the story straightforward as a survival story. And in this case, I could see that. It's a good argument that starting in media res undercuts the stakes. Because if you started off with Joel, like right where the credits begin, start the movie there. You have this depressed person who's going to start a procedure. Like, I almost wonder if I could see it that way. I'd love to have Charlie Kaufman on. I'd love to sit him down and ask him a few questions about that. That's a really good point. It's a good criticism. I hadn't really thought about that.
I don't think it's bad that the movie started in media res. It definitely benefits from it in certain ways. But it's kind of a trade-off. And I think that's something that you have to consider a lot in writing is sometimes there is a trade-off of certain decisions that you make.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, it's clearly a trade-off they went for, and they went for it, you know, pretty boldly, like doing it out of order in a movie that's already feels like it's out of order. So they're taking a lot of risk. But it's definitely a smart movie.
Yeah, I think it works. Just for me personally, it's something that didn't quite mesh with my experience watching it.
Okay, cool. Fair criticism. All right. Well, that wraps up our vivisection, our deconstruction for Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Still one of my favorite movies. I love this movie so much. I'm going to keep watching it and keep studying it. And I would love to, Charlie Kaufman, if you see this, I'd love to sit down with you and ask you a million questions sometime.
You want a vivisection.
You've got a story inside you, a screenplay no one has ever thought of, a novel you've been rolling around inside your coconut for years. Maybe you wrote a few pages and stalled out. Maybe you even wrote a whole draft but don't feel confident it's any good. Or maybe you've been writing draft after draft after draft and slamming into writer's blocks or dead ends or wandering into the weeds. Maybe you just have a few scenes centered around some dope high concept, but you don't know how to develop a character, much less construct a plot that would generate a character arc. Maybe all you have is some simmering spark of an idea, just a simple desire to write a story. This book is for you. Story by Numbers is a step-by-step process. It gives you the tools to construct a plot that fleshes out your story with characters so real, so compelling, so multidimensional, you'll begin to wonder if you're possessed. Story by Numbers is composed of three parts. Part 1 gives you an overview of the 4-act structure, 24 plot points, 8 sequences. Part 2 is a 35-question examination of your story that will guide you through developing and outlining your novel or screenplay into the 4-act template. Part 3, well, that's just next-level dope shit. This isn't just another book on theory. Story by Numbers is a diagnostic toolkit for developing and fine-tuning your story. You'll also want to pick up the Story by Numbers workbook. For each story you're writing, you'll need a journal to organize your ideas. The Story by Numbers workbook is a companion notebook that walks you through the process as you outline your story and guide you through each phase of development. From constructing your protagonist's internal drive, to plotting conflicts that expose character, to composing scenes that drive compelling stories. By the time you've completed your Story by Numbers workbook, you'll be ready to finish your manuscript. Whenever you ask a writer what it takes to write a good story, they usually say there are no rules. If you want to know what they really think, ask them about a novel or movie they hate. Immediately, they'll unload a litany of do's and don'ts so specific, so precise, you'd think they're citing commandments. We all know following a formula is what turns stories into zombified, hacky imitations of better stories. You don't want a formula. You want a process. A method composed of practical principles that breathe life into your concept. You don't want some bullshit magical key. You just want to know what works and what doesn't. Does your story resonate or not? Everyone knows there are no rules for writing a great story. Now that we've gotten that out of the way, here are the rules. Story by Numbers. Write more, better, faster, doper.